Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is Morteza Hajizadeh, your host from Critical Theory Channel. We're glad to have Joseph Allen Boone with us. He's the author of a wonderful book called The Homoerotics of Orientalism. And today we are honored to have him with us to talk about the book. Joseph, welcome to New Books Network.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Let's just get started with a very brief introduction about you. And maybe in your introduction, you can tell us how this book also came about. This is one of the most important books in the area of Orientalism, but it's quite different from other typical books in the field, such as the books such as Joseph Massad's Desiring Arab or Edward Said's Orientalism. So this is called The Homoerotics of Orientalism, and it's quite a large book, and I'm guessing it took you about 20 years to put all the materials together, right? So tell us about yourself and how the book came about.
Okay, happy to do so. In terms of my professional affiliations, I early on identified myself as a specialist in the novel as genre and its English language permutations from the early 18th century through present times. So I'm a literary scholar by training, and that work has always, since the dissertation, been inflected by my interest in issues of genre and gender and sexuality, which over the years and decades has leaned more and more in a queer context as queer theory has come into play and influenced the literary and cultural studies field. My work has moved from very specific studies of the novelist form to then larger cultural formations like modernism, to in this book, expanding to really be a cultural study of 400 years of representations, written and visual, high culture and pop culture, that I argue illuminate the ways in which West and East have othered each other in eroticized terms, particularly ones that involve fantasies or realities of male homoeroticism. Now, this book came about, I'll go ahead and, lead into that in an interesting way that sort of glosses what you were saying as its 20-year gestation period, where just by happenstance, I was reading, and this may have been the early 90s, Lawrence Durrell's Alexandria Quartet. A student had recommended it to me for a modernist course in which we were looking at modernism and sexualities. And he said, I think this magnum opus by Lawrence Durrell is filled with, seems to me, sort of queer homoerotic stuff. So, of course, I wanted to read it. And that was my initial interest. What are all these subtexts of homoeroticism, male homoeroticism doing in the work of this I'm trying to think of a funny way to say it, but Lawrence Rill has a reputation as a womanizer, and this book is the four books that make up the Alexandria Quartet appeal to a large majority, I think, heterosexual readers. It's filled with sort of expectable sexual excess, but within that, all the myriad male and female couplings that the four novels represent. It's this curious subtext of homoeroticism, both male and female. And it's like, what is it doing here? And then it dawned on me, well, of course, this must relate to the context, the fact that all of this is being contextualized in a mythicized Alexandria, Egypt, in the world, the period of the sort of Second World War. And that led me actually to read seriously Said, which I just had skimmed before. And, you know, delving into Edward Said's masterwork, you know, gave me a certain critical terms for looking at this, the way in which the Middle East becomes this screen on which Western minds often project fantasies of what they think they can't have at home and seek abroad, and attempt to, and it becomes an act of appropriation, of course. It's part of the definition of Orientalism, aggrandizing the other for your own purposes. Or for giving expression to your forbidden fantasies. Within Said's context, though, I noticed that it, by and large, that eroticized via metaphor relationship of West and East for Said, of course, means the Middle East, largely speaking, is heterosexualized, where the West is represented as, or represents itself as, the masculine conqueror of this effeminized, supine, ready to be penetrated, exotic East. And I thought, well, all fine and good, but how does that feed into the homoerotic currents other than ones that would simply, you know, feminize the queer figure itself? And so that led to my first attempt at this book, which was simply to look at Western representations of the Middle East. And I was really focusing on the more colonial periods of in 19th and 20th centuries. And that was, you know, that was an interesting project. It sort of was, its outcome was foreordained, in that you know, the punchline was always there. Here's the West once again, albeit now in a form of homoeroticism rather than heteroeroticism, you know, using the Middle East and its fantasies of Middle Eastern sexuality in essence for its own fantasies. And what happened was, I'm sorry, this is a long explanation here, but what happened was, I became chair of my department for many years. I put the book aside. When I came back to it, it was really the late, it was around 2008, something like that. I looked back at what I'd done and I thought, oh, this is too predictably post-colonialist in its sort of thrust. Maybe outdated in its sheer emphasis on Western representations. Who cares if we think already that they're going to be, they're at fault and whatever for what, the way that they're projecting things on the other. But in face of saying, I don't think I like my old material that much, I don't think it goes far enough, I was delighted to find the number of works just then that were appearing by Mideast scholars on Middle Eastern sexuality and those deep histories thereof. So that gave me one new resource to read at. I was on a fellowship at the Huntington Library, so I decided to research their archives. And that was sending me increasingly to 16th, 17th, 18th, century travel narratives and such that were enriching my own stereotypes or perception of what these Western projections onto the Middle East in terms of sexuality were. So two things happened that expanded my frame of reference. One was beginning to account for this whole 400 to 500 year period of interchange encounters between Europe and the Middle East as the Middle East opened in the early 1500s to more and more trade and access to the West. And then as of the time period expanded, and then I became more and more interested in looking at, as much as I could, Middle Eastern texts themselves that went back, it even predate the period in which these Western narratives began looking at the Middle East with an eye to what sexual perversions are going on there, kind of thing. And I ended up in this book with a very, not a totally different argument, but I was much more interested in accounting for not only what these projections by Western travelers, fiction writers, et cetera, onto the Middle East were about when it comes to their perceived vision of sexual relations between men or men and boys in the Middle East, but how those very representations were always already framed by pre-existing Middle Eastern narratives and social cultural histories that were in part inflecting those Western representations. And, you know, it led me, you know, on one level to see that these were not simply fantasies projected by Westerners, but fantasies intermingled with maybe misread, but nonetheless perceived social realities throughout the Ottoman Empire, for instance, that were inflecting their orientalized versions of what they were representing. So in essence, this book, as opposed to my early work when I was beginning this project, attempts to be very contrapuntal in its reading. I borrow the term from Said, in its reading of Western and Eastern representations and context, and to make room for the crossovers continually happening among these regions in order, in some sense, to destabilize those two easy oppositions of here's the West, here's the Middle East, or here's heterosexuality, here's homosexuality, identity versus acts in terms of defining sexual identities and stuff. So I think the project became richer, became more cognizant of contradictions that are not necessarily explained away, and hopefully dismantle some of the sort of rhetoric that we find too often in the public press when it comes to the East and the West, where the two are always seen as somehow always opposite, instead of things, you know, entities that have touched on and influenced each other. And in terms even not only sexuality, but even in terms of homoeroticism, have certain things in common.
You've raised a number of points that I do like to unpack as we go forward. So if I want to sum it up, is that, well, according to what say, the East has always been orientalized and sexualized, but your argument is that it's not always a fantasy of the Westerners. There are also stories within the Orient, within their literature, art, cinema, poetry, that has a lot of those representations that the website is only ascribing to the West. And so I guess that's where your work departs from Edward Said.
Right.
And you in the book, let's start with a story in the book. Like you open the book with an example of a three-minute pornographic film from 1920s or 30s. So how does this film speak about the overall argument in your book?
I opened my preface with three examples from sort of what you call pop culture, low culture, because sometimes I think those most graphically make apparent patterns that then sort of invisibly insinuate themselves in the public imagination. And in this case, I came across a six-minute 1930s French pornographic film titled Mektub, It Is Written, which seems the perfect straight Orientalist fantasy, where a Western man who also is named Dickie, and has a camera, one of those old-fashioned cameras that projects forward, he makes his way into the harem. He breaks into a harem, and this is realizing the Orientalist dream, the Western Orientalist dream of penetrating the mysteries, mostly all fantasized of what must happen with all those women, at the disposal of the sheik kind of thing. So he's there, just a few women are there. He proceeds to have sex with them, at which point the sheik comes home, interrupts him, and as a punishment for having sex with his wives, the members of his concubines, the members of his harem, he subjects intrepid Dickie, the Western photographer who's been taking pictures of everything, to sodomy. He sodomizes him while he makes the Western guy fillet his manservant. So you have this moment, intense moment of male sex happening for 30 seconds. And then it goes back to heteronorms, and where everyone's just having a delightful orgy, isn't any pornographic film. What to me was so telling is that you have this sort of ellipsis or parenthesis in the, it just right in the middle of your typical straight Orientalist fantasy, penetrating the harem with all this phallic force and indulging in the delights of the other forbidden sexuality here, forbidden meaning a plenitude of female pleasures to sample. But in the middle of that, in that parenthesis, is this totally homoerotic moment. And that happens repeatedly in a lot of Western Orientalist text about the Middle East that seem to be focusing in on sexual license in general and the fantasized pleasures of female plenitude, but then yield for a moment to a scenario or unexpected sighting of what the Westerner is compelled to deem male-on-male sexuality. And so I'm asking, why does that occur so much? And we all cultures eroticize other cultures. And but why does homoeroticism so often enter these fantasies of the Middle East was my basic kind of question there. And that sort of film seems to epitomize a way, it's almost like a fetish there, it's there 1 minute and then it disappears kind of thing. It's sort of like the ghost that can always peek out of the closet and show its head. So to me, that film is a great example of how the homoerotics of Orientalism often insinuates itself into Orientalist fare.
Yeah. So in research about Orientalism and homosexuality in the Orientalism, Western scholars Western scholarship is usually dismissed as an Oriental work. And you talk about two critics in your book. One is Afsaneh Najmabadi, and the other one, Janet Afray, who point out the same thing. So I want to know if your research, your critique, has been challenged or has been, let's say, dismissed as another Oriental representation of the West, of the East.
Yeah. Fortunately, I've escaped that by and large, and most of the reviewers of the book have themselves come from Middle East studies departments and have been quite laudatory and grateful for my attempt at least to make Western and Middle Eastern representation sort of speak to each other rather than exclude each other, and see the potential for that expanding a field of study for all of us. Sure, there have been some, no one's called the work Orientalist. There have been some people who think it doesn't go far enough in creating that conversation, to which I think it's true too, because of the own limits of my knowledge of Middle Eastern sources, which have relied on what's been translated very recently or things that I've had translated personally for me, and things like that, to enrich my sense of the past sexual histories and cultures of the Middle East. But it's a delicate kind of thing. These critics you were citing, are sort of, you know, it's humorously say, you know, just to raise the term homosexuality in discussing the Middle East will get some people's approbation, fear that you're raising a taboo, or immediately categorize that person as Orientalist for even raising what they fear is a Western sort of stereotype. I think the best one can do is just be very truthful and honest about your position, about how much you, what you do know, what you, the limits of your own knowledge are, and to make clear that when you are describing things that are of a sexual nature, to be one, very straightforwardly, but not voyeuristically clear. And doing that by making sure that your readers or people who are listening to you when you're speaking are convinced that your use of explicit materials are really, you know, central parts of your argument. It's that you're not just sitting back saying, oh, look at this scene unfold and that scene unfold, or look at this licentious representation, but that it's part, an integral part of an overall argument. And so it's actually worked out incredibly more positively than I expected in terms of the reception of this work.
And I think one of the great things about the book is that you'll have stories and examples from both East and the West, and you study them side by side, which brings me to the next question. Uh-huh. So in your book, you have this story of Tahir and Tahib, and you read it against the martyrdom tale of the British monk and theologian Pelagius. The story of Pelagius is more or less well known to the Western audience. So maybe you could tell us a little about Tahir and Tahib. And when you study these two stories side by side, so what does it show about the treatment of homosexuality in both the West and also the Middle East?
Okay. And first I would pause on what you said just to say that I generally, when I talk about these homoerotic relationships in Middle Eastern texts, tend to always use homoerotic or male-male sexual relations and not homosexual, because that's where you can get into trouble with people thinking you're imposing a Western sexual category onto sexual cultures that may have male-male romantic and sexual, you know, existences, patterns, but where the terminology is different. But what is neat about looking at, say, this, I think it's early, it's a mid-17th century Ottoman tale, is that it is essentially a captivity story where two Ottoman youth are captured by infidels, which means the Europeans, and who then fall in love with their captors, and their captors fall in love with them. And it's a happy ever ending story because it, to take out all the various suspense things and stuff occur in the tale, which is really long verse tale, is that the two captors, the Europeans, are miraculously converted to Islam and sail off to Istanbul with their two boys, and they live happily ever after in the rose garden of delights until they reach the garden of the heavens or something like that. And so it's a captivity tale with a happy ending. The European, it's an anonymous manuscript I found that was written contemporaneously at the Huntington Library, concerns, it's just the opposite. A French youth has been kidnapped by Ottomans, where he's beset by the licentious sodomitical, not the master of the house, but the overseer. The youth, in his good Christian way, refuses all advances to the point of martyrdom. So he's eventually put to death. And when you read the two against each other, you find all these unexpected congruences and differences that make it, on one hand, even the Christian fable becomes rather implicated in its own subject matter, because in upholding the holiness and chasteness of this Christian youth who holds out against the infidels' sodomitical desires, the narrator spends an inordinate amount of time describing the boy being stripped of his clothes and his beautiful gymnasium-like body, you know, burning at the stake or whatever. So, you know, there's this voyeuristic implication into what you're supposedly horrified by, which is sort of the homoerotic desire, but the narrative is sort of betraying itself. Well, even in the happily ever after Turkish tale that I was talking about, there's a certain social realism that creeps in time and time again, this fantasy story. The most pertinent of which would be that in the tale, the two pairs of lovers go back to Istanbul and live happily ever after. But nothing's ever mentioned of what would be the social reality of Turkish male lovers, which would be that it also have their wives and their children. And you lived a script where you had both family and your beloved often. So it creates its own fantasy that you might not realize as much as fantasy until you put it into a larger context.
Let's also talk about chapter two, talking about some stereotypes about Middle Eastern homoeroticism. There are many of them, and you talk about one of them, which is one of the most common, is the beautiful boy, the beloved of man, which again is related to the question I just asked previously, and also about male sexuality in the region. There are also other tropes such as hyper-virile man or a eunuch. Can you talk about these stereotypes and how do you extend readings of these stereotypes to call into question these stereotypes or assumptions?
Yeah. It became so apparent to me the more and more research I did that there are these sort of trans-historical types that you find in these representations, both by Westerners writing about the Middle East, and these go back to your early travel narratives through sort of high-flung Byronic romantic writings and stuff. But they're also there, many of these sort of tropes, which become stereotypes through repetition in Middle Eastern literature as well. And one of those is that the trope of the beautiful beloved, loved by a lover, a male lover. And one of the things I tried to show there is the degree to which this, you know, Western stereotypes would often use that as a way of damning, obviously, the relationship. What you find in reading these texts is that the age of the beautiful boy can range from 13 to, in one case, I found it where the beautiful boy is a 38-year-old or something person. So being the beloved or boy is a more plastic, elastic state or range than one might think. Other stereotypes sort of fall apart when you look at multiple of these representations. The stereotype would be that the beautiful boy is more or less epicene or effeminate, and therefore he can fulfill sort of the female quote-unquote role in a pederastic male adult beloved youth sort of relationship. But in point of fact, some of these beloved objects of desire are wrestlers, are policemen, are soldiers, are street toughs. Very masculine and macho, little bravado things. And likewise, this gets into another stereotype that I try to decenter when I take up the trope of sodomy, that the stereotype is if there is in the history of the Middle East, a pattern for male-male sexual relationships, it is that of the older male penetrating the younger youth who substitutes, quote unquote, for the unavailable woman due to prescriptions on male-female contact, say. But what I tried to show is, or what I find in the evidence, is that even those roles of active, passive players are not, in much of the literature, necessarily hooked to the age difference of the players. So you have reversals where it might be the male poet in a verse who's looking forward to being penetrated by the younger but very randy youngster. There's also a large number of particularly miniaturist representations that depict egalitarian relationships where the partners are same age. And again, that breaks the stereotype of age differentiation being a necessary component of the way in which sex between men can be imagined in the Middle East. The other stereotypes, the one of the eunuch is in many ways much more a Western stereotype. The West from the Enlightenment forward is just fascinated by the figure of the eunuch because it sort of interferes with all one's assumptions about what is a male, what is masculinity, and the very fact that the eunuch is the one male person who has egress to the female harem, you know, drives these Western men crazy in their fantasies. And then at least the questions of, but what does, you know, castration really mean? What does it affect and things like that, which then gets into a deeply anxious Western anxieties about, you know, masculinity at its core, you know, what makes you a man or not. So that one is one more I've seen in the Western literature. Eunuchs are ever present in Middle Eastern literature, but they aren't weighted with that kind of symbolic freight of, oh, this is really meaningful in a kind of way. Yeah. So, and the one of the other sort of tropes I examined that you find a lot in both both literatures, East and West, is that of the bathhouse or the hammam as a site for male tryst. And it, again, in my recounting of both, you see how images of one infiltrate the other and how each sort of how the fantasies sort of become intermingled with the social realities thereupon.
And in treatment of homosexuality in Eastern literature, well, Eastern scholars generally interpret that male bond as a metaphor or as a yearning for union, for the divine, rather than homosexuality. I remember when I was in high school, we read a lot of poetry, Persian classic poetry, and whenever there was even the slightest connotation of male-male bond, it was quickly interpreted as, this is not carnal desire, this is not like earthly love, it is spiritual love in poetry, or it's not even earthly wine, it is a spiritual wine, which is a yearning for the divine. So how do you, did you come across anything like that, or how do you respond to this glossing over, let's say, of homosexuality? Because I guess, and maybe you could also respond to the next question that I had as well, which is when researching homosexuality in the Middle East, because most of the countries are Islamic countries, so there are challenges in both researching those items or, let's say, recasting the trope of homosexuality as something which is not physical or carnal at all.
Yeah, no, of course, this is the traditional interpretation, say, of the Ghazal, the love poem. And it's very endemic to Sufi practices, where entering the trance-like state that gets you to a spiritual level involves gazing upon the beautiful youth, kind of thing. And that's true, that this is one way in which beauty and youthful male beauty is used, right, in the literature, but it's not the only way. And to me, the analogy would be between the way that you were taught the poetry as a high schooler and the way I was, say, taught Oscar Wilde's Dorian Gray in high school, which was, it was really about all these other issues. And homoeroticism was never mentioned, and the text is rife with it. So it's not just about identity and the doppelganger self and all these things. Because I have high schoolers that, you know, come into my class and we're reading Dorian Gray, and we never saw any of this when we were in high school, but wow, it's there. And it's a bit the same case, I think, with that older academic reading of a whole history of Arab, Ottoman, and Persian poetry, which is fixated on the beautiful youth, where sometimes, yes, it is all about the cosmos and reaching this greater union, but sometimes it's too explicit to be anything but intimating a physical reality. And you get this by, if you gloss the poet's biography sometimes with the poems, and in the biographies you'll have mention of, you know, their companions or lovers, that then you can find the names sort of hidden within the poetry itself, say, or in the physical representations you simply get explicit scenes of male intimacy, romance, and congress that you can't deny. It's right there visually. The poetry, like all good romantic poetry, makes very subtle what's there, but it still exceeds the limits of what would be simply spiritual. There are too many sort of material traces there that bring it down to earth, as it were. But, you know, I would like to say in a sort of idealistic way that the spiritual and the earthly are always connected.
Yeah. And how about, in your introduction, to the book, you mentioned different sources you use. You use travelogues, photography, cinema, literature. Now, I'm kind of intrigued by the cover photo, which is a photograph by Lerner and Landrock, if I'm pronouncing the names correctly. So you use a lot of examples from photography, photographic erotica, let's say. And this is more or less a modern genre at the beginning of the 20th century. So why from written text, travelogues, literature, you move to visual culture? You can talk about visual culture, maybe, and photography as well.
Yeah, I hope everyone who's listening at least goes online and looks up the cover so they see this arresting photograph of this the only word for it is sort of like beautiful young man. There's nothing really, you know, and I'm using Western terms here, but it's not effeminate or feminine even. It's beautiful in a way that defies some of our categories, I think. But of course, it's a stage studio photo, which we've got to take into consideration too. This isn't just someone walking down the street who was photographed. This is all orchestrated to meet the gaze of some hypothesized viewer who's going to buy this image, because that's what Leonard and Landrock were all about. There was an influx of photographers in the early 20th century, mostly German, it's interesting, to the Middle East, who took pictures of everything and sold them to whoever would fit that category. So, you know, you'd photograph the Holy Land, so you'd have all the sort of Christian religious sites that would sell back in Europe. You would just have, you'd have pictures that were more, you know, the market or something like that, which, you know, would satisfy people's curiosity just about what the visual look of a place might be. But you also had a very lively commerce in erotica, what one critic calls ethnopornography, because these are photographs in a way using the guise of ethnography. Oh, we're showing different cultures as a way to suggest the sort of forbidden or hidden sides of other cultures as well. Okay, these are the sexual mores or whatever. And so you have lots of what would be predictable quasi-soft pornographic representations, women in the harem, lounging, nude or half-nude, sometimes male-female couples. That's your greater category. But you had some of the artists who were doing holy scenes and doing these sort of, like I'm, you know, harem scenes, also doing these pictures of nude youth, male youth, sometimes fully nude, sometimes tantalizingly half-clothed, sometimes in couples. And these were obviously selling to some nascent gay-aware community in the West who's buying these, you know, because it's inciting certain desires. So these become another, you know, text in that whole history of homoeroticizing of the quote-unquote Orient. But I tried to show how a lot of these pictures also talk back to the audience who might be buying them, that it's too simple to simply see these as natural representations. And we can read in their staging all sorts of ambivalences and subtext that, again, add nuance to our picture of East, Middle East sexual traversals or crossings over. I'm trying to think of other images that would be, well, I'll think about it and I'll bring it up again if there's a specific image. It's hard on a podcast to describe an image effectively in terms of analyzing kind of the work it's doing. But I assure the readers there are just incredible, some of them are incredibly interesting images. And some of them have, you know, great artistic merit in their own right. This is a case in point to one of your earlier questions about you brought it up with the Iranian critics, but and what becomes salacious if one doesn't present it carefully. There are some of the photos that would lend themselves to thinking this is truly pederastic or pedophilic. And it's worst case, these, you know, photographing these young, nude, pre-adolescent guys. It turns out that what our eye, our Western eye, reads as pre-adolescent isn't, that the lack of pubic hair is actually a cultural, you know, thing of shaving oneself that makes the youth look pubescent to a Western eye, but isn't. Do you see what I'm saying there? That's sort of complicated. But so the viewer is tricked into getting something that he thinking he's getting one thing, but is not. And knowing that this is actually the same model, the 17-year-old model that's being has been used in a variety of photographs, puts a whole different slant, not a wholly different slant, but it also speaks to the agency of that model and being able to work to all sorts of scenes with the photographer in hand.
When I first saw the cover photo, when I first came across the book, I thought it was the picture of Prophet Muhammad. And the reason is that because when I was a kid in Iran, there was a very, very similar, there has never been a blanket ban on representing Prophet Muhammad in Islam. So, and that picture is still circulating in some households. So he was a young boy. You might have seen the picture. You're nodding.
Yes.
A young boy,
We're not. It's fascinating because there is an article that's been written about this where the same model here and some different shots, but similar. You had the turban and the flower on the side. Some of those photos made it into the Arabian Peninsula and around the 40s and were adapted as watercolor and pastel sort of prints that were then marketed as pictures of the prophet, where the article talks about every home had framed versions of this. And so it's just a wonderfully deconstructive sort of moment to realize that images of the prophet and the spirituality that indicates has its origin, that representation, in an appropriation or borrowing of a image from created by Westerners for homoerotic gain and profit. Again, it shows how sometimes all the what seems impossibly oppositional collapses. Mm. And there's a conduit that connects them.
Yeah, that's a perfect example. And when I was a kid around 6 or 7, I do remember walking to some houses. That picture was framed up on the wall. And it was like, because I was a kid, somebody told me that for the first time, this is a picture of the prophet, right?
Yeah.
And that's I was a kid.
It's fascinating to hear your eyewitness sort of account to what this article was doing. And, you know, this is actually, I thought about reproducing some of those images to show them in contrast. But that was one of the places where I thought I didn't want to go too far in offending sensibilities by showing what had been taken as a representation of the prophet is now, you know, put up side by side. So that was, you know, that was one of those instances in which I chose to exercise some decorum.
Yeah, and I remember that some people even treated that picture as something holy, like Quran, because Muslims don't touch the text. They when they pick up Quran, they kiss the book. So some people, even when they pick the picture, they kiss the picture, treated it as something holy. And to me, it was just, I was a kid, I didn't know anything about homosexuality. So, but like when I was a teenager, I thought, well, that picture doesn't really go well with the description or the way Prophet Muhammad, for example, the stories about the wars he took part in and the way he brought all the people of Mecca together, you know, to establish Islam. So that picture doesn't really go with that person that I have in mind. But yeah, when I saw the picture, that was the first thing that came to my mind. There you go. That's the origin. Let's talk about another part of the book. In your book, you have plenty of examples from Turkey and Egypt, and some examples from Persia as well. So what is so fascinating in particular about those two countries? And I do like to ask a second question as well, which you can address as we go further. So Iran or Persia has always been, again, this oriental other from the perspective of the Arabs. Like sometimes, because maybe it's not an Arab country. It speaks a different language, which has a lot in common with Arabic. But in terms of the religion, they are a minority in Islam. They are Shia, and they're more, in a way, if that's the right term, too, they're more liberal in their religious ideology compared to really our Orthodox Islam. And that's why, again, you have sometimes stories of homosexuality being attributed to Iran by Arab writers. So first, maybe you can tell us why you decided to focus on Turkey and Egypt so much, and also talk about the representation of the other from the perspective of the Middle East, like Persia is the Middle East other as well.
I agree with you there. It's interesting. It came down to source material in a way, looking for what congealed around certain themes that then I could make the nexus for chapters. I mean, at one point I thought I might have a chapter on the African Maghreb because, you know, there's all this literature about the Morocco and Tunis as well. And I think, at one point I thought of a more sort of Arabian sort of section and all, but I didn't want it to be just geographical. I thought, okay, I'll use a few examples. And it seemed to me that I found more overlapping text when I focused in on Istanbul or Constantinople, and then when I focused in on Egypt in terms of its sort of either Alexandria or the Old Kingdom. And in each case, those lent themselves to stories that I felt I could gather a lot of material around. In the case of the Ottoman Empire centered in Constantinople, you have these tropes of amplitude and bounty and sort of an excess of polymorphous desire, I guess, but the city is typified by it, say, in all these older representations, Middle Eastern ones, and then picked up by Europeans. And then it filters into the way that sexualities themselves are elliptically alluded to in those texts. So I run a gamut of analysis from early taxonomies of sexuality in Constantinople in the empire through to the French writer Pierre Loti's book Asiadée, which is supposedly about a soldier falling in love with another man's wife, a woman he steals from the harem and puts up as his concubine. But as a text, it is inundated with references to a subculture of homosexuality in Istanbul that the narrative is always just glimpsing or just closing the door on or just alluding to the fact that he knows more than one should know if one's not part of that culture, kind of thing. And so in a sense, the relationship with Asiadée, the woman, becomes a veil for another story that's being told, which happens in a lot of these texts that center around Istanbul. And I take that right up to this monumental, 17 volume encyclopedia, popular encyclopedia that this Turkish scholar created, which is littered with homoerotic material. And yet this is in everyone's house, just like the pictures you were talking about on the walls of people's houses, but done in a sort of innocent way that sort of they always pass. But still, if you sort of ferret out the examples and line them up, you think, whoa, what's going on here? So that was a lot of the nexus of the Turkish Constantinople Ottoman Empire chapter. And the one on Egypt came naturally because of so many Westerners who went to Egypt, like Gide, Flaubert, Durrell, all focusing on it, that made it seem apt as a category. Where I do the most with, I think, the Persian heritage, I mean, it's littered throughout. When I refer to some Persian poetry and texts that exist in counterpart to the Western representations I'm bringing up. But it comes up most forthrightly toward the end of the book where I deal with the miniaturist tradition in detail. And most of my miniatures are Persian. Some are Ottoman. A few come from Cairo, of Arabic sort of origins. But that visual sort of heritage or archive is pretty incredible for what it shows once you learn how to decode the images, you have to read them differently than we read Western art, just on an aesthetic level, but then on the level of content too. But once you sort of crack the codes, you have more than ample evidence of a sort of visual representation of male love.
A surprising thing in the book is the appearance of Norman Mailer, right? Heterosexual. What does he have to do with homoerotics of Orientalism? Why do you bring him up as an example in the book?
Well, Norman makes his guest appearance in one of my chapters on Egypt, because Mailer wrote a novel called Ancient Evenings. I think it was in the very late 1980s or early 1990s that he thought was his masterpiece. And the critics didn't, I must say. Everyone was anticipating it as the big one. This is, you know, going to be the summa of his writerly prowess. And I use that word deliberately, because Mailer is associated with nothing if not machismo. And yet in this story of ancient Egypt, and this, I mean, he's mythologizing a whole, you know, what he thinks ancient Egypt religions and culture was like, of course, but it is inundated with homoeroticism. And it's sort of like, it's, you know, Mailer's repressed coming out. You know, it's not to cast any kind of aspersions on Mailer's sexuality, but to, it illustrates a way in which, once focused on a Middle Eastern locus, and here one, you know, historically embedded as ancient Egypt, it triggers. And this, you know, avowed heterosexual's imagination, all of these visions, not only of homoerotic relationships between men to be abhorred, but ones in which he imaginatively participates to a degree that is fairly staggering, as he depicts the relationship between his major character and one of the pharaohs. I think it's Ramses II. It's all very complicated. I only recommend the most daring of you to read this novel, because it, everyone has a ka or different, or more than one reincarnation of self. So you have multiple selves of any self interacting with other selves. And since everyone's identity boundaries are permeable, of course, anyone can enter anyone else's body. So that's a kind of sex with, you know, multi-sexed sort of relationship anyway. But what's interesting is there's all this agonizing stuff about domination and submission between the general and the narrator character for like 300 pages. That's the plot each time. And it ends in forcible rape each time that turns into pleasure for the submissive figure. And then it's almost like Mailer's realized he's gone too far. It's like that pornographic film I discussed at the beginning, where it's like you got to overlay this now, like, oops, I've done enough of this, maybe. And so it suddenly becomes a heterosexual love triangle where Nefertiti, of all characters, becomes the beloved object. It's one of the pharaoh's concubines that the narrator falls in love with. next and starts to forget the pharaoh. So anyway, it works things out on heterosexual terms in the last 200 pages. But it's like, you've had your fun, and now we go back to the norms that we realize, you know, are the sort of building block of Western civilization, which is his use. In some ways, I guess that's his Egypt is the foundation of civilization, which is of us. But again, it's that I guess it makes it fascinating for me is the degree to which with so many Westerners, whatever their proclivities, when they come into an encounter with this sort of unknown or semi-known Middle East that they're prone to over-sexualize in the first place, it's almost as if a door opens in their imagination that allows them to entertain erotic relationships between men that would have never been permissible in any other context.
So as a last question, the book is filled with a lot of examples. And one of the ones that I really liked are the examples of Turkish and Persian miniature. And some of them are quite suggestive. What did they suggest to you in terms of your main argument in the book?
I really had to do my research here because I'm not an art historian. I certainly didn't know the miniature tradition until I started reading up on it. What's fascinating is the levels of male homoerotic desire that are depicted in images, and sometimes it can be very subtle. I'm looking at a page now that you can't, that the reader can't see, 316 for you, but often images would be disaggregated from some original source and pasted together in albums. And there's a page here where there are four single shots of different youth. You know, there's nothing necessarily erotic about that. But it's the way that the compositor has put together these pages so that images are talking to each other and bringing youths into Congress that, you know, begins, if not to... there's just a suggestion that there's meaning in the arrangement, and that arrangement does bring types together and ways that create sort of like in that bottom image, a relationship across the page. A similar sort of reading of arrangement can be found in some Western albums of collectors of Persian miniatures who you can tell the images in one of the museums I went to are all loose now, but you could tell via the wormholes that have been eaten into the pages how the collector arranged the images. And then you could see that he's absolutely putting all the beautiful boys together, all the two guys together, scenes together. So he's making his own sort of erotic taxonomy through his arrangement of images. But then there are other images that are much more specific. If you look closely enough, one of my favorite ones, and this one's easy enough to describe in words, is a bath scene in a Turkish bath. And it's actually based on a very famous 16th century bath that much was written about and what occurred there. And on first glance, are all these people gathered around what looks like a big hot tub to us, in the water, on the sides, talking to each other. There's a barber there, so some of them are getting their heads shaved. Some are getting scrubbed down. You know, everything that should happen in a bathhouse, which were ubiquitous. Everyone went to bathhouses. It sort of looks like, you know, guys frolicking. It's good-spirited fun. You know, some guys are wrestling in the water and things like that. But then you start looking closer and blow up this little teeny miniature. And Lord knows how you got paintbrushes fine enough to do things like this. But then you'll realize, like, say, for instance, there's one barber kneeling behind the boys whose head he's shaving, or young man whose head he's shaving. And his robes have parted. And so his genitalia are all there apparent. And there's no reason to make that apparent unless the artist wanted to make them apparent. But it takes a certain eye to find that. And then same with, then you realize that the two U's diving into the water, they're in their little loincloths, but actually the loincloths are transparent. And so there's a difference between your surface reading and then you look closer kind of reading. Same with another image. It's also from the Tapaki Museum Archives. Really great image of, it's called After the Debauch or something like that. And you have some guys, you have one older guy who clearly is drunk and fainted on one side of a lily pond. Then you have two youths who are just chatting. Sort of half clothed. And the intimation, this is the aftermath of one of those sobey or garden parties. It was a whole Ottoman tradition where men, lovers would bring together their youths and they'd all read poetry to each other and eat fruit and drink wine and whatever. But this is really depicting it as what the after the debauch kind of thing. And what you notice if you look closely again are that the boys' undergarments are all transparent and you can see their tumescent penises through the transparent material. And so it's not overtly pornographic at all, but if you look closely, they're in states of arousal. So there is, it's not just beautiful boys anymore. So using your eye like that, you find lots of interesting things. Another way of reading the miniatures that I found fascinating were all these images of two boys together and kinds of embraces that you can also, in Middle Eastern culture, it's very typical for men to hold each other's hand or arms around the waist and all, and one shouldn't over-eroticize that. That's not fair. But if you look at the way these boys' limbs are entangled, they imitate the patterns of arabesque design, which in the purpose of that kind of design is to show how everything is interlocking. And just the direction feet, arms, legs, sort of intermingle and where one limb disappears and another pops out and all makes the two into one so that you have a sort of kind of congress happening in the visual symmetries that are being created through the arabesque of the bodily limbs without it being overly sexual. But then you'll see that one's holding a book in one hand, but that's a book of love poetry. The other's holding a goblet of wine that's slowly dribbling out of its face instead of sort of like spilled liquid desire. So all these things will have little meanings for the original viewers, the connoisseurs, that add to the erotic meaning of what seems like, youthful play. Does that give you some good examples?
Yeah, and the pictures that you made, like the wine bearer and youth bringing wine, that's, again, in my culture, I've seen lots and lots of those images. They're printed on cups or plates, and they're so common. And I was always intrigued when I looked at those paintings myself as a kid again, how most of them look, they have the Asian look, they look Chinese, and the reason that in Iran, the miniature art came from China.
Yes.
Yeah, but I was always amazed, like how the way they were represented, young, quite young, and if you put a critical lens on it, there are sexual overtones to that as well, as you mentioned. Professor Alan Boone, thank you very much for this fascinating conversation, and I do encourage our readers to pick up the book and at least go through it, because there are lots and lots of beautiful examples and images, and if you don't really want to read the whole book, you can still read bits and pieces of it that speak about the pictures. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you.